This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited to be speaking to Dr. Hester Barron about her book titled The Social World of the School, Education and Community in Interwar London from Manchester University Press. This book is fascinating. I admit I'm slightly biased. I currently live in London, so I had a particular interest, but I think for a lot of people, this book that examines why schooling, sort of what was happening with schooling at this time, why this matters to our wider understanding of 20th century Britain and 20th century socioeconomics, a whole bunch of different things. Because Hester's book really helpfully does an in-depth investigation into kind of this particular world of the school, but also integrates that into other things in terms of modern social history. So there's a lot to get into with the book. And so Hester, I'm so pleased that you've joined us to tell us all about it.
Thanks, Miranda.
Could you start us off, before we get into the book itself, introducing yourself a little bit and explaining sort of how you came to this project?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Hester Barron. I'm a professor of modern history at the University of Sussex in the UK. I'm a social historian. I'm a historian of modern Britain. So I teach and I write about modern British history. This book, it was in development for a long time. It feels like it's a long project that I finally got to the end of. So I was actually pregnant when I first started doing some of the research. And my son is currently applying for secondary school. So it's been a long kind of journey. And obviously I did other things in between. So I published two other books in between. But because I think with any project that sits with you for such a long time, my ideas changed quite radically over the course of the 10 or so years that I was working on it. So when I began it, I was interested in writing a fairly straightforward lived experience of the classroom. That's what I was interested in. That's what I wanted to find out more about. But as I did the research, I became increasingly interested not just in the kind of internal relationships of the school, but thinking kind of outwards to think about families and the wider community, the local community, the local economy. Chronologically as well, I was interested in, I started thinking about the past scholars as well as the futures of the pupils who were in school, their futures as parents and voters and workers. And so the book, in the end, really turned out to be a story about the social relationships that shaped interwar Britain. So there's not just pupils and teachers in the book, but there's parents and neighbours and doctors and clerics and local businesses and school managers and so on. And I thought that was important because for various reasons, social historians of modern Britain generally haven't paid that much attention to education. So if we look at the interwar years specifically, for example, there's been a lot of amazing work recently on issues of community and identity and looking in nuanced ways at the complexities of class and gender and ethnicity. But a lot of histories of this period pay relatively little attention to, either children's experiences or the social history of schooling. And so my book was about, or what I wanted to do in the book was to argue that actually the school is an essential lens through which to view the history of the social history of interwar Britain, and that schools really mattered and really matter, should matter to the historian for two reasons. So one is the kind of anchor role that they play in the community, because obviously what happens in schools affects children, and that in itself should be a reason for studying them, because children's experiences are no less valid than those of any other historical group. But they also affected the broader working class communities around them. So they were kind of embedded in daily life. So schools matter for that reason. And then there's also, they matter because of their role in social change from the bottom up. So this is one place, schools are one place where aspirations and expectations develop, and a shift in attitudes towards education is more commonly attributed to the post-war, to the post-Second World War years. But actually, I think you see that shift in attitude towards education amongst parents and children in this interwar period as well.
Thank you for kind of introducing us to the process and a bit of the behind the scenes of the book, because I think that sets up kind of what the book actually does really helpfully. And I'm glad you highlighted sort of the number of different kinds of people involved in the story, because I think that very much is one of the richnesses of it, to help us really understand, as the title says, right, the social world, not just one particular interaction. Mm-hmm. And I imagine, and in fact, I sort of know this because I obviously have read the book, there were a lot of very cool sources you got to use for this, a lot of very interesting sources. So I was wondering if you could maybe tell us a bit about kind of the materials you were able to use for the book.
Yeah, sure. I used a lot of different types of sources. So I used kind of government, local government records and the kind of official reports of education committees and so on. I used memoir, oral history. I didn't do any of my own oral history, but I used oral histories that have been done previously. Textbooks, a little bit. I looked at textbooks. My most important source base was school logbooks. And school logbooks were kept by the head teacher of every school, in the same way that, you know, head teachers today will have to keep records of what's going on in their school. And it could be the most basic kind of information. So things like a child falls over in the playground and has to go to hospital because they break their leg, or, you know, a teacher's absent because for whatever reason. And head teachers were required to keep these very kind of bare details in their logbooks. And thousands of these logbooks are held in the London Metropolitan Archives. That was my main archive. And some teachers wrote literally a few entries a year, a couple of sentences, you know, little Johnny fell over, Mr. Smith had tonsillitis, whatever. But other teachers packed them with information about what had happened in the school on any particular day. And that means they become really time-consuming sources to use because the evidence is so fragmented and diffuse. But they can be hugely rewarding because the evidence you can collect there can be absolutely beautiful in its ability to conjure up particular moments of classroom life. Sometimes you can even follow individual children through the school. And what became particularly useful as well, so the other big source that I looked at was school inspection reports, which are held at the National Archives. So they're school inspection reports of individual schools, which were done every few years. And by matching up the logbooks with the inspection reports was particularly useful because the inspection reports usually gave socioeconomic details about this school and the area and the children who attended. So I was able to get a sense of the different types of school, socioeconomic groups that were attending the school. The logbooks were also useful, as well as this kind of detailed diary that you got in some of them. They were also a treasure trove of unexpected material. And clearly, you know, teachers would have this huge, thick kind of tome sitting on their desk. And they clearly, some of them just kind of used it as a place to file away newspaper cuttings or sports day programs or administrative instructions or other material that they clearly didn't know where to put it. So they just kind of shoved it inside the logbook with the anticipation that at some point they'd get around to filing it properly, and then they never did. And so quite a few of the most illuminating sources that I use were just serendipitously preserved in that way. So there's a child's school report, for example, or a letter from a parent or a pupil's essay or a school magazine or I think those kind of things that are so hard to access otherwise. And sometimes the chance nature of that could be really frustrating. So there'd only be half of a letter from an ex-pupil to a teacher, for example. Or there were quite often things like exam questions that the teacher had written out, obviously, to give to the classes. And then they file away the exam questions, but we don't have the answers. There was a gorgeous set of exam questions set to the children of one school in 1930. And it asked, the teacher was asking them to write about the differences between a man and a gentleman, a native and a foreigner, and wanting food and needing food. And you just think, oh, what would you give to get those answers from those children about what they thought about those different things? So, yeah, in terms of sources, I've always been a bit magpie in all my research, but the logbooks were a particularly rewarding, well, a lot of effort, but a lot of reward that I got from them, and they were my main base.
And what a cool sort of type of source. And I remember reading in the book when you talked about these kind of exam questions without the answers, I was like, no, I want to know what the students would have said. And perhaps my initial thought was, I want to know what would have been considered correct.
Yeah, well, yes,
which
exactly.
Would have been fascinating. But despite those gaps, we do have quite a lot from the logbooks that is in the book. So thank you for sort of explaining that. And I think the magpie-ness is something a lot of historians will very much identify with. So I'd love to move kind of into some of the sort of key parts of the book. And the kind of obvious place to start with is sort of, why was this important, right? Why did education matter so much? And it really does come through in all these different kinds of people involved, that the stakes felt really high, right? Parents were really quite invested in sort of what was happening in the school, among others. So can you help us understand kind of what the importance was of education in this particular time period?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think by 1918, education mattered more than it ever had. In ordinary people's lives. So in 1918, exceptions to the compulsory school leaving age were abolished. And so from 1918 onwards, all children from the age of 5 to 14 were receiving a standardised experience of education for the first time. And so for many, schooling or son or daughter's experience of schooling was a constant of everyday life. And I think generational change is important here as well. So by the 1920s, children at school will have had grandparents who were also at school. And in fact, by the 1930s, children probably had great-grandparents who'd been at school. So schooling was just a normal, that's part of, it's become part of childhood. And then schools mattered in all sorts of different ways. So they acted as sites of welfare, preparing children for their future lives. There were ideas about class and gender and nation develop. And then you've got the many and varied interactions that schools have and teachers have with the local community. The other thing I would say is that I think the interwar period itself also represents a kind of particular democratic moment if we're thinking about the relationship between schools and their communities. So obviously you've just had the First World War, and that changed expectations of state institutions, and it also altered the relationship between citizens and government. So war service, obviously people had worn uniform for their country. Then you've got the extension of the franchise in 1918, which offered new and democratic and egalitarian concepts of citizenship and social inclusion. In the interwar period, you've got rapid technological change and the politics of consumption that were changing aspirations and expectations. And that applies, I mean, I focused on London and maybe we can come back to that, but that applies to London possibly more than anywhere else in the country. And schools then became, or therefore became, a kind of important place for all those reasons where children and parents maybe had a different kind of role to what they'd had before. So parents, for example, might exercise an increased role as ratepayers, their voters, their consumers. And the other thing, of course, is in terms of looking forward, is that these children are going to be the children who grow up to be the generation who vote for change in 1945. So I think I've worked, a lot of my work has been focused around the interwar period, not just this book. And I think it's a really, I think we sometimes tend to forget about it because obviously it's sandwiched between the two world wars and the two world wars get a lot of attention. But I think it's a really important moment actually in terms of thinking about social change.
So given some of those kind of particular dimensions you're speaking about, and obviously anyone who studies British history knows that London is often an exception or different or remarkable in a particular way. So can you maybe tell us a little bit about kind of why you focused on London?
Yes. So I, from the beginning, really, I was quite clear that I suppose because it started off about thinking about being really focused on the classroom as a kind of lived experience of the classroom. I wanted somewhere, I decided that I didn't want to do a national study because I needed somewhere that I could get the kind of, do the really detailed source work in a kind of micro history way. So, and do the things like matching up the logbooks with the inspection reports and so on. And even for London, that's a big task. But I thought thinking about national might have defeated me a little bit. So I wanted somewhere kind of discreet. But London was also a good choice in terms of its variety as well. So obviously an enormous socioeconomic variety, literally sometimes in the same kind of very small district, you get, you know, extremes of wealth, you know, living a couple of streets from each other. And therefore that obviously affects the schools because those children are going to the same schools. There's variety in terms of ethnic background. So pockets of London, or large areas of London where there's big Jewish communities, for example. Things like mobility rates differ in different parts of London. So there's some areas of London where there's rapid turnover of population. There's others where, you know, you get the same generations staying and going to the same schools over decades. So I thought London, for me, struck the right balance between being able to do that really detailed, intensive source work, but also being able to get the spread. It's obviously not the same as a national study in that these schools don't represent, I don't know, tiny little village schools in rural England and Wales, for example. But it gave me a spread of different, of contrasting experiences. Hmm. The other thing about London as well is that it was, that the London County Council was self-consciously progressive in these years, as were other some other councils around the country. But London also had the kind of heft, the financial, you know, it being bigger and it not quite as hit by poverty, perhaps. And some of the northern progressive authorities. And so I think, again, what I was trying to see in terms of thinking about changing attitudes to education and so on, I think in some ways you see that in London happening in the interwar period, where it takes kind of the better economic conditions of the post-war years before you see it elsewhere in the country.
Mm. I think kind of what you spoke about of the different neighborhoods being very different, but literally physically next to each other or intermixed, mm-hmm. and how that impacts the school, I thought was one of the really interesting sort of explorations of the book of what impact does this have in the world of the school, particularly for things that maybe in areas with less difference amongst neighborhoods, it would be sort of harder to disentangle kind of what impact education had on how students felt as compared to other things. So I was really interested and quite pleased, really, when you sort of explained how mixed in a lot of ways these areas were that kind of all had the same skill, that you addressed the idea of kind of identity and belonging and sort of the role of education in that. So I was wondering if you could tell us about kind of your findings around what role skills and education played in creating some sort of unified feeling of identity and belonging given this London backdrop.
Yeah. I should say, of course, when I say that you've got extremes of wealth, obviously not all of those children are going to the elementary schools. And I should just explain quickly what elementary schools were. So obviously you've got children going off to the richest kind of level of children going off to private schools. But London, across Britain, elementary schools in this period were the state schools that the vast majority of children went to between the ages of 5 and 14. 14 was the leaving age, so age 14 they left and they got a job. There's a minority of children, so we're talking maybe 15%, who had the opportunity to win a scholarship at the age of 11 to go to a secondary school, or they could pay to go to a secondary school. So again, amongst the middle classes, that you tend to get children leaving the elementary school age 11 and going to secondary school. Secondary schools charge fees so that you don't get free secondary education in Britain until after the Second World War. So because they charge fees, they were better resourced, they were more academic, they were more prestigious. So my research was just on the elementary schools where, unless you could pay or you got a scholarship to go to secondary school, children would just stay at the same school, same elementary school, until they were 14. So sometimes there's an assumption that it kind of matches onto primary schools or what we would think of as primary schools, and it doesn't quite. It's kind of primary schools plus the children who don't go to secondary school. Does that make sense?
Yes, that does. Thank you for clarifying.
So you asked about, anyway, identity and belonging, and you've still got the vast majority of children going to these schools. So as you say, there's still this big variety of children from different backgrounds and so on coming. And thinking about how schools created those feelings of identity and belonging, that actually made up the first chapter of my book, because I think in a lot of the literature around the history of education, the school is assumed to be disruptive to a sense of unity. So the school is posited as a battleground for the clash of different interest groups. In the British context, that's often class-based, but histories of schooling elsewhere have also emphasised classes or tension between different national or ethnic identities. And obviously, I don't want to downplay that, and obviously that was the case in different places at different times. But in interwar Britain, I found that a lot of schools were making a really dedicated effort to try and foster a sense of collectivity and unity. And there were various ways that they tried to do that. So in these years, school uniform became more common. So not necessarily the whole outfit, but poor schools, even the poorest schools, are reporting that children are wearing a school cap or a school badge. School house systems are introduced, school magazines aren't as rare as you might think, some schools have school songs, a lot of schools have school mottos, you get schools putting up honour boards in the hall to record significant achievements by pupils or ex-pupils, there's school sports, of course. So there's a lot of effort being put into kind of creating a brand almost, or a kind of sense of loyalty to the school, and they didn't always succeed, or there were obstacles that might hamper that. So facilities, some schools might not even have a school hall where the whole school could assemble, for example. But more problematically for the historian, it's also, it's kind of easy on one hand to document that those kind of initiatives are taking place, but it's much harder to gauge the impact on children. Because obviously just because they belong to a schoolhouse or they wear a school cap doesn't necessarily mean that children then feel a loyalty or identity to school. So one of the things I was trying to do was try and find evidence that might help with kind of gauging children's reactions. And there are smatterings of evidence that we can use to show that they had a positive effect, at least on some children. There are lots of examples in memoir of people recalling their school days fondly. And there's probably an element of nostalgia there. And actually, though, you can find equally lots of memoir in which people remember their school days not very fondly. So I was trying to find kind of contemporary sources. And there is contemporary evidence to show that the school was appreciated by pupils at the time. So head teachers recording the visits of ex-pupils, for example, who dropped in to say hello, to catch up. One of the things I looked at in more detail was ex-scholars clubs, old scholars clubs, old boys clubs, old girls clubs, which were being established in numerous schools in these years to provide social events or support for continued learning. And I think those kind of efforts came through very strongly in the sources, but also the fact that students or ex-students were responding to them. Again, there's a problem with the or a difficulty as a historian is that the logbooks privilege those pupils who remain engaged. So obviously they record the pupils who come in and say hello. They don't record the pupils who don't come in and say hello. As initiatives that were taken are much more likely to be recorded than initiatives that aren't. Schools that didn't do stuff they just have empty logbooks rather than, you know, filling it with this, that and the other. So there is a trickiness around kind of quantifying the absence of evidence. But then nevertheless, I thought that the kind of sustained engagement of many ex-scholars with their old school was still really striking across lots of different schools and lots of different logbooks. Mm-hmm. And that comes out in the book, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it was really interesting and kind of leads nicely to sort of another thing that I really appreciated the book looked at, which was this idea of kind of the social world of the school, but also the communities it's in, and kind of this idea breaking down this perhaps obvious but false idea that kind of the school wall is sort of everything that happens within them is one thing and everything that happens without them is something else. So I was wondering if you could speak to kind of what your research found in terms of, were the schools separate? Were they seen as separate from their surrounding communities? Kind of what was that interaction like?
Yeah, I mean, that really gets to the heart of what I was trying to do with the book, because as you say, there's this kind of assumption, or in the contemporary discussion and in some of the historiography as well, that the elementary school is often represented as being very different to the home and street in its values, in its ethos, and the kind of assumption that there's an inherent tension as well between school, which is kind of seen as a state imposition, and the home, which is about working class community. There is a difference. Then, you know, they're not the same kind of institution. In the interwar period, a common reason why schools should be valued was because of their, or a common reason that was given as to why schools should be valued was because of their civilizing function. And that language of civilizing was explicitly used by educationalists who saw schools as a way to develop, middle-class educationalists who saw schools as a way to develop morality and behaviour and citizenship in working-class children, and to offset what they saw as in usually pejorative, through a usually pejorative lens, to offset the effect of working-class parents. And architecturally as well, you know, the schools stand out. So in London, a lot of the schools are the old Victorian board schools with their imposing architecture, their, you know, red brick, large windows, gable ends. If you walk down a street in London now, you know, they've been converted to flats or offices or whatever, but you can always pick out what used to be the old school. And so it made it easy for commentators to characterise them as alien to the working class communities around them and therefore representative of a different set of values. But my argument in the book is that even if that was the intention, and even if we can document that civilizing purpose that was set out by educational officials and inspectors, that purpose might have been the theory, but that wasn't always how it worked in practice, and that actually that purpose was often modified maybe by teachers who might have a more pragmatic sense of their district. Parents might have alternative ideas about how the school could be useful. Children themselves, of course, have their own thoughts, and that might change. Their thoughts might change as they get older. It was different for boys and girls. There are concerns of the local community. So local industrial firms demanded good workers. Local mistresses wanted good servants. Politicians wanted good citizens. And so schools were, you know, they're not just this discrete institution that plonks down in the local community and its four walls. You know, children come in, have a, you know, exist within the four walls and then they leave, but they're connected. They're very much tied into the local community in all sorts of different ways.
Thank you for explaining the different ties. And I think even just that sort of last sentence is such a great encapsulation of it, right? Parents wanted one thing, students wanted another, local industry wanted something else. You know, there's just so many different pieces here. But of course, there probably is some sort of truth to the, you know, some fire for all the smoke of the idea that there is a difference, that they're at odds with each other. And of course, when we think about kind of frictions between the school and around it, parents are kind of the obvious source, you know, parents and teachers. So what did you find sort of common areas of friction across the variety of London, or did it change? What did those kind of differences tend to look like?
Yeah, so there were various things that might cause friction between schools and parents. Corporal punishment is probably the most common one. And that's not necessarily the fact of corporal punishment itself. But if there was a feeling that it had been used arbitrarily or particularly viciously. Although I did come across the comment of one parent who wrote to the education officer about her daughter in protest about her daughter who'd been obviously punished at school, and she wrote that my child is not at school to be whacked. She is there to learn and to be taught. I can do all the whacking my child wants. And obviously that's a good example of the parent valuing the educational function of the school, but obviously thinking that discipline is something that she needs to do in the home. And there's also tensions over cleanliness. And again, that's something that trespasses on the role of the whole home and the family. So when children were sent to what were called cleansing stations because they've been found to have nits or lice or that kind of thing, for example. So yeah, absolutely, there were frictions. And but again, part of the argument of the book in terms of thinking about the relationship with the local community is not that it had to be a happy relationship the whole time, but that relationship existed, right? That sometimes it was tense, and sometimes it was in support, but that the schools were negotiating with the local community the whole time. And actually you do find lots of instances, in fact, the emphasis in the sources is on a more harmonious relationship between parents and schools. So inspection reports are a good source for this. And they, because they don't hold back, if they think something's wrong, you know, if they're not happy with the relationship between parents and the school, they don't hold back and they say so. But actually, across a range of reports, and you know, I looked at something like 1,000, the suggestion that a school has good relationships with its parents are much more common than the opposite. And schools courted parents. The best schools actively courted parents, and a lot of the mediocre ones did as well. And so parents appear in school life in all sorts of ways. So mothers might make costumes for school plays, or they send in fruit for harvest festivals, or fathers come in to help decorate a school hall, or they help tend the school garden. There's an expansion in the number of open days in this period, so schools opening up their doors to parents for the day, and some record, you know, literally hundreds of parents attending, or parents come to sports days or other events. And again, I think in terms of seeing these changing attitudes to education, you do see parents clearly appreciating the education that their children are getting. So often serendipitously, in the way that I said before, you know, because it's been tucked into a logbook, I came across letters from parents to teachers thanking them for this, that, or the other. I mentioned generational difference earlier, but I think it's important here too. So sometimes those parents had been to that school themselves. Maybe they'd even be taught by those teachers. And in those parts of London where there was little mobility amongst the population, you get those lines of continuity across a generations of a single family attending a particular school. And so that school then becomes a reference point across decades.
Which was fascinating to read about, and really kind of brings us back in some ways to that conversation about identity and belonging, which I found really interesting. But I sort of want to, now that we've talked a little bit more about parents, I kind of want to pick up on one of those other actors that we mentioned, which is about employers. So Can you tell us about kind of what education was sort of preparing students for afterwards, and to what extent that was kind of reflected in the curriculum?
Yeah, so as I said, for most children in this period, they're leaving school at 14, and any educational opportunities beyond the elementary school were extremely limited. So the vast majority, 80-90%, are staying on in the senior departments of elementary schools until they leave and go to work. So there were academic scholarships, as I said, available at 11. Then there were supplementary ones at 13. And actually, talking about friction between going back to parents for a second, that could actually be another cause of friction between school and parents, because parents were sometimes criticised for turning down scholarship places with the assumption that this was, typical working class apathy to education. But obviously there were other reasons why parents might turn scholarships, not least because the cost of uniform and books and so on, and all of those kind of things that weren't covered by the scholarship. But as I say, that's scholarships are a very small minority. Most children, therefore, are being prepared for work when they leave at 14. And so actions to prepare children for their working futures were taken within the school. And as you say, this is where the kind of local economy comes in. So head teachers might deliberately cultivate links with local employers. Came across examples of teachers, writing to local employers and getting them to visit, or getting kids to visit, go out to the factories. Lectures, teachers might organise lectures by the local labour exchange. Teachers might volunteer at evening institutes. There was a survey in the 1930s done by the council that showed about half of London's the elementary senior schools were taking pupils on school trips to industrial firms. So that might be, you know, taking their kids out to visit dairies or factories or the gasworks or wherever it might be, but to get a sense of industry. Now, obviously, that means that half of senior schools weren't doing that. So this wasn't happening everywhere. And also, again, there can be that disconnect between what the school thinks is good for children and what parents think is good for children. You particularly see that over attitudes to domestic service, which head teachers generally think is a really good job for a girl to go into, but parents are much more hesitant about it. So parents don't like domestic service because they associate it with drudgery and servitude, and also because it means that their girls have to go and live away from home. There's, in terms of what the school is teaching the children and preparing them for the futures, there's also practical work as well. So that's things like cookery and laundry for girls, and it's woodwork and gardening for boys. And again, some of that is explicitly framed around employment. So geometry, there was at one school, for example, where geometry was taught unusually in the art curriculum of a boys' school, because the particular factories in the neighbourhood required geometric drawing. Or I came across a girls' department that was deliberately choosing its sewing machines to match the models of sewing machines that were used in local factories. So again, you've got this, it speaks to the connection of the school, and again, that embeddedness in the local.
I found those details really interesting. Kind of just, you can imagine sort of the thinking and the conversations and all sorts of relationships that would have been necessary for those things to kind of manifest themselves in the sort of evidence we can see, which really does kind of build this more multifaceted world of the skill. And this is, again, not the only aspect of it, because the book also looks at welfare. And I thought this was particularly interesting, going back to your point of these are the children that then vote for change as adults. So can you tell us about sort of what welfare initiatives were being brought in through the schools in this period and what the kind of reactions were?
Yeah, so this is really important as well. And to some extent, schools had always been sites of welfare. So individual teachers had always been a source of welfare to individual pupils. Then you get the new liberal reforms before the First World War. So they're the legislation which introduced things like school meals and medical inspections. And it means that by the interwar period, welfare was becoming one of the school's kind of primary and formal functions. So the most important duties are things like the provision of milk and meals, medical inspections, treatment of children, measures to get rid of lice or vermin or whatever. Many schools then took on additional duties, so maybe quite ad hoc, maybe liaising with charities or running boot repair classes or negotiating with local baths to get subsidised rates for pupils. Again, if you read the official documents, the London County Council in this period and the Board of Education nationally actually really raved about the success of their child welfare programmes, and London in particular was held up as a leading authority. Kind of self-congratulatory impression dissipated at the start of the Second World War, because of course the condition of the child evacuees from London and elsewhere became a bit of a scandal and dented their claims that the conditions of schools had got so much better. But nevertheless, you know, there's stuff happening. Maybe not to the extent that the council promote. I came across a funny, well, it's not really funny, it's sad really, entry in a logbook where there was no local swimming baths, so the teacher took the boys to the cinema to watch a film that showed different swimming stroke methods, and that's as much as they could do. And obviously a lot for individual schools as well, a lot depends on individual teachers' enthusiasm and motivation. But yeah, there are welfare initiatives happening. There's also a lot of poverty in London. In terms of how parents and children responded, there are lots of oral history memoirs that recall the physicality of school as a warm, safe place. Again, there are others that give the opposite impressions. And so I was kind of searching for contemporary sources to suggest that school could make a difference. And again, there are smatterings of evidence that suggests that at the time, children really appreciated and parents really appreciated this kind of stuff. One of my favourite examples is from a magazine called Labour Woman, which was a magazine for Labour women. It ran children's competitions every month. And in 1926, it ran a children's competition. It asked for drawings under the heading of School After the Holidays. It published the winning entries. One of the winning entries was a nine-year-old from London. And she'd done a picture of children running around in the playground, and she'd captioned it, "Getting fit after the holidays." And so that was what school meant for her. It wasn't, you know, we go back and do maths, or we go back and we learn about history, but it was getting fit. It was, you know, her physical health that returning to school was going to help. And I've got evidence that parents appreciated welfare measures too. And maybe that shouldn't be surprising. Of course, parents were going to appreciate, you know, measures that helped their children. And again, this tends to be a stereotype of parents and teachers at loggerheads, but here they were often allies. You know, they both sets wanted what was best for the children. And sometimes parents therefore were actively consulted on welfare measures. And logbook records suggest that a lot of the head teacher's time, and particularly headmistress's time, was taken up giving advice and support to mothers who came in asking for help on a kind of range of issues. In terms of the regard in which head teachers were held, I was particularly struck. There were quite a few instances where there'd been an incident over the weekend. So say a little girl had been flashed at by a stranger, or, you know, a strange man in the area, or something that was, that there was a reason to, something had happened over the weekend. And on Monday morning, the mother goes in and talks to the head teacher about it. And then it's the head teacher who then goes and speaks to the police. And that says something about the relationship. Again, that the school is a source of help, welfare, advice, that parents are going to the head teacher as their kind of first port of call. I thought that was quite significant, and it happened. There were a few examples of that.
I thought that was really interesting, and again, kind of gets rid of this myth of sort of always being an adversarial relationship, and there being a lot more nuance. But speaking of kind of what's best for the children, I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about kind of the political side, in a sense. Not that anything we've been discussing is not political in some senses, but one of the things that children were taught is how to be good citizens, whatever that might mean in a particular time and place. So can you tell us about kind of what this meant in this time and place? What was a good citizen in this context? How were these values taught?
Yeah, so there's been lots of scholarly interest on citizenship and attitudes to citizenship and citizenship education. And as you say, it varies in different periods. So there's been lots of, you know, people are talking about citizenship before compulsory schooling comes in the 1870s. We still talk about it now. So citizenship lessons were introduced by the early 21st century. I think it was 2002 in schools. Again, I think it's particularly important in the interwar period because of the adjustment to a mass democracy, and that massively changes the relationship of, you know, citizens with their government. One of the big debates in this period over citizenship education is about whether to teach it directly through timetabled lessons on what was called civics, or indirectly through subjects like history or geography. And there were groups, there were external groups. So the Association for Education and Citizenship was founded in 1934, and it lobbied for specific lessons on citizenship. I've got a nice quote from one of its supporters that where they say, "Oh, it's much more important that people know who collects their bins than who cut off Anne Boleyn's head." So there are groups that are lobbying for specific lessons on civics. Civics as a separate subject, though, it was decided that wouldn't be taught, because it was decided that actually there was more than enough indirect teaching through subjects like history and geography, where a patriotic kind of narrative could be taught, and children could be taught about bound to their country, I guess. And you've also, of course, got the celebration of empire. So that you've got the maps on classroom walls, which were ubiquitous. You've got posters on classroom walls from the Empire Marketing Board. In these years, you've got the British Empire exhibition held at Wembley, which was in 1924. That was visited by something like 190,000 elementary school children in school hours. Most of those had been London school children. And of course, you'd have got children going independently with their parents as well. Empire Day, that was held on the 23rd of May every year. That was Queen Victoria's birthday. That was observed by the vast majority of British schools in the period. So there's lots of ways in which citizenship obviously by citizenship, educationists are also talking about things like patriotism and empire and imperialism and monarchy and so on. There's lots of ways in which those values are being transmitted to children. Ideas around kind of how do children absorb ideas of nation and patriotism and empire has had lots of attention from historians. I mean, for obvious reasons, but I wonder if it dominated a child's education as fully as we might think. And actually, I think sometimes it was a secondary aim. It wasn't the kind of main purpose. So there's another example that I came across of a school exam, again, or a school test that I really like, that I found in a logbook. So this one's from 1930, and the children... it's just a head teacher who's filed away in the logbook a little scrap of paper where he'd written the questions that he was asking the class. And children were being asked to choose between two questions. So the first question they could ask was to write an essay which asked about, I can't quite remember how it was phrased, but it was something about why is peace more important than war? And it was asking them potentially to reflect on Britain's role in the world and internationalism and maybe the League of Nations and the First World War and so on, all that kind of big stuff. Or the other option they could choose, and each, you know, it was an either or question, was describe a crossword puzzle and how to solve it. And I think that they're kind of juxtaposition, that actually sometimes not only obviously with children not necessarily thinking about the wider messages, but I think sometimes even the school wasn't either. And it wasn't a kind of conscious, there wasn't so much of a conscious effort to dictate what children were thinking about stuff. Mm-hmm. And that the mundane and the everyday was just as important.
I think that's really important nuance in understanding education in any time, in understanding history. So I'm really glad that you've mentioned that. And speaking kind of any time, would you mind explaining or sort of discussing what you think similarities we might see, continuities we might see between this period of interwar London schooling and maybe today's education system?
Yeah, I mean, it was something that I was constantly struck by as I was writing the book, the kind of echoes that reminded me of today. So as I alluded to earlier, this kind of book grew with my son. So I've kind of been through primary school with him. And I was constantly being reminded of stuff. So things like the debates over the curriculum, the juggling of resources, concerns over urban pollution, which are as big in London in the 1920s as they are now, worries over effects on children, exam cramming, it comes up. And of course, all of that in the interwar period is against a background of economic austerity and the threat of war, which unfortunately, of course, you know, both of which we've got today. Those echoes got, if anything, they got stronger when the pandemic started, and they made me really think about schooling today. So most of the actual writing of the book was done during lockdowns. And obviously that was a strange time to be writing. It was a strange time. But to be writing something that reflected on schools and schooling felt particularly odd. So at the time that I was writing, you know, I was measuring a successful day by whether or not we could keep homeschooling going beyond about 11 o'clock in the morning. And of course, all the way through that time, schools, or the absence of schools, were constantly in the news. So by the third lockdown, the government was belatedly saying that school was the most important place for children to be. But in 2020, pubs and shops opened before most schools. You had Marcus Rashford in the news, the campaign to extend free school meals, and the role of school as an absolute critical lifeline for children being able to eat. There were concerns by children's charities about the invisibility of vulnerable children if they weren't in school. There was a lot of concern ongoing about children's physical and mental health and what they lost if they couldn't be at school. And there were other things as well, that smaller things that kind of reminded me of or made me think about parallels of the interwar period. There was a note that had been entered into a school logbook in 1922 that headmistress was absent from school owing to nervous exhaustion. And I was reading this in 2020 and thinking how on earth her counterparts a century later could possibly be coping. But those kind of current concerns really shaped how I wrote the book. And that question of what are schools for, why is it important for children to go to school, was so present in the pandemic as debates raged about when and how to reopen. And so writing it during the lockdowns, it was a question that was constantly in my head. And I ended up writing the book, organising the chapters of the books around that question, what are schools for? And different chapters look, well, as you know, at the different function of the school. So the function of the school as a site for welfare, or the function of the school as in terms of preparing pupils for the future, or making citizens, or whatever it is. But I think, to end on a more positive note, I think hopefully that, or rather it gives us grounds for hope that actually thinking about these parallels, we can be maybe more optimistic. So my research showed that schools can make a difference. So in the bleakest of areas in the interwar period, in the most deprived and the poorest of areas, there were schools that did everything they could to make their children's lives better. So they took children swimming, they put on Shakespeare plays, they taught children the violin. I was struck by how many, even in the poorest areas, schools that were putting on violin lessons for children. And I guess it's a reminder that, you know, if we can invest in them, if we value them, if we value our teachers, schools really can make a difference.
That is a lovely note to end on. And so I really only have one question left, which is obviously this book, as you've mentioned, is something you've worked on for a long time and other projects during that period as well. So is there maybe a project you're currently working on or looking to start working on that you could give us a sneak preview of?
Yeah. So I'm having a bit of a pause at the moment. So I finished two major projects in the last, since the end of the pandemic, actually. So obviously this book came out this summer. But over the last couple of years, I was working on the social world of the school, I was also working simultaneously on a trade book that I co-wrote with my friend and colleague Claire Langhammer. And that book is called The Class of 37. And it uses the school essays that were written by a group of 12 and 13 year old girls in Bolton in the northwest of England in 1937. It uses those essays to think about their lives. So they wrote these, this class of girls wrote school essays on a whole range of topics like what I did on Saturday, what I think of the royal family, what I want to do when I grow up. And all these essays were collected by the research organisation Mass Observation and preserved. So we use their essays, and we also trace their descendants to find out a little bit more about how these girls' lives turned out. And so that was a really lovely project to do. But it means that I've published two books in the last 18 months. So
a break is very deserved.
Pause. I've just finished a really hectic teaching term. I've got a couple of smaller projects ongoing, but I'm taking a little bit of time to work out what the next big project is. So we'll see.
We shall see. Well, while you are resting very deservedly, listeners can read the book that we've been discussing again, titled The Social World of the School, Education and Community in Interwar London, just out in 2022 from Manchester University Press. Hester, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.